Okay, so let's get started. Today we're essentially just finishing off chapter 4, which is starting on section 4.4. And what we're going to do here is essentially just talk about the properties of Einstein's equations. And so this is really a wind down in a lot of ways, because if you've already looked through the notes, you'll see that this isn't quite as mathematical as some of the other things you've seen. But, you know, it's still very conceptual. So, in Einstein's equations, you've actually got 10 different equations. And that's because you've got these rank 2 symmetric tensors, one on each side, Einstein's equation on one, Einstein's tensor on one side, stress energy tensor on the other. And in four dimensions, since they're symmetric, you've got 16 elements, but since they're symmetric, that reduces down to 10 in four dimensions. And the Bianchi identity basically says that the divergence of the Einstein tensors equals zero, and that is equivalent to the divergence of the stress energy tensor equal to zero, and that gives you four constraints on the Ricci tensor. And therefore, since there's four constraints and you have 10 different equations, that means there's six independent equations that you get from translations. And another property of Einstein's equations, these are very difficult to solve. You may have guessed already. And that's mostly because they are nonlinear, and you know, the nonlinearities come through when you look at, you got metric terms multiplied by other metric terms, and you have derivatives of the metric multiplied by that, and there's a lot of these components floating around. And when you get to a very high curvature, they get even more nonlinear, and these are all the products of derivatives of the metric. And symmetry and assuming a vacuum are going to simplify finding a solution. And this is why the first solutions to Einstein's equations that anybody ever found were vacuum solutions. And by vacuum solutions, they mean the right-hand side is equal to zero. Sort of like that one problem with the electromagnetic field. I think it was problem 4.6, where they said assume that, you know, you got an electric field, but you're assuming it's a vacuum. And so we just make this vacuum to make the stress energy tensor disappear, and it's easier to solve. You know, the thing that's really interesting in Einstein's equations is if you can just create some kind of matter-energy distribution, you can create a space-time that works around it. And these nonlinearities can be physically interpreted as a gravitational field that couples with itself. And this is one of these really interesting things in Einstein's equations. Is that, like, if you look at classical, non-general relativistic physics, and you look at, like, electromagnetism, we can represent an electromagnetic field with a photon. And a photon does not interact with other photons. Photons are uncharged, so they can just hit each other, you know, basically just go right past each other. It's no big deal. Gravity, on the other hand, if you have something called a graviton, which transmits gravity, then these gravitons can actually interact with each other, even if they're massless particles, because they curve space-time, but they're also affected by the curvature of space-time. So gravity actually affects itself. And if you have something like a gravitational wave, and this was this interesting thing that I learned when I was in graduate school, is that you can create these gravitational waves by basically moving mass up and down. And this moving mass is going to cause space-time to ripple the same way you give your electromagnetic waves. The difference is the gravitational waves, if they get big enough, they can actually collapse in on themselves, and you can actually form a black hole by just gravitational waves without any matter involved. And the gravitational waves have the property, if you do the full gravitational wave picture, they're actually nonlinear, and you can't get a periodic system. Like, normally you can use electromagnetic waves and say they're periodic over time. Gravitational waves, you just approximate them as periodic, but they're not actually periodic. And so one way of seeing this is if you look at scattering, and these are Feynman diagrams which you would use in quantum field theory to calculate scattering. You've got two electrons that come in towards each other, they exchange a photon, and then they move off. And that's how electrons scatter off of each other. They don't actually come in contact with each other. And so this is the same thing as the electromagnetic force interaction between two electrons. The gravitational interaction between the two is they come close together, they exchange a graviton, and in which case that would actually cause them to be a little bit attracted to each other because they're both positive mass. But here's the thing, gravitons can come in, see each other, and interact, and then scatter off or collapse on each other. It just seems weird because you couldn't imagine two photons interacting like this. So gravity is different than the other forces. Electromagnetism is actually the only linear gauge theory, and it exists in what we call the U1 Abelian group, which means that it commutes with itself. And so if you look at the strong force or the weak force, and you have gluons and you have W bosons from strong and weak force, those actually interact with themselves and therefore nonlinear. And so electromagnetism is the only linear gauge theory where the force carrier doesn't interact with itself. Gravity can also be described as a spin 2 particle. And one way to think of it as spin 2 is that, you know, you've got two indices on the metric, and so it's because it's carried by a tensor, and that number of indices can kind of give you the spin of the boson. And it's also a member of the SO31 non-abelian group, meaning that it's nonlinear. And you can see here, SO31 stands for special orthogonal three spatial dimensions, one time dimension, where U stood for unitary. So there was a lot of... you can actually describe gravity through particle physics, and that's what they do in string theory or something like that. And as an example, we're going to look at the ball example. And this is from page 167 to 169. And what happens is you've got this ball that is made up of individual particles. And they're all following a geodesic. And so if you do this, if you like try to follow what's going on here, you get this equation, d theta d tau is equal to all this junk over here. And you can see this depends on the Ricci scalar, and these are the four velocity terms. And this is called the Raychaud's equation, and it's actually derived in Appendix F of your book. This is one of these things that I just don't want to waste all your time going through in class. And you can see that U are the four velocities of the particles that are moving along the geodesics. Theta represents the expansion, which is like the divergence of the four velocities. Sigma is shear, and omega is rotation. And so if you put all these terms in, you can get how this ball is expanding over time, because what happens is when you drop it in a gravitational field, there's going to be tidal forces, and there's also going to be self-attraction between the different particles. And if you take this and you crunch it further, you can see that this also applies to Einstein's equations, where this expansion term is actually going to look like this. And basically what they did is they started off with that equation, and they said that d theta d tau basically is equal to minus the Ricci scalar, Ricci tensor in a coordinate system where it looks like flat space. And then they went from there through Einstein's equations to give you this. And so what this tells you is that if the density is greater than zero and all the pressure is equal to zero, then it's like you have a bunch of dust particles. And effectively, they all contract under gravity. And so negative expansion or contraction. If you had, on the other hand, if you had the pressure dominating over the density and it was all negative pressure, it could actually cause this thing to expand outwards. So this is just describing how anything or any collection of bodies is going to behave in this gravitational field. And so the expansion of the volume of any set of particles initially at rest is proportional to the sum of the energy density and all the pressure components. And so this is just something that's really interesting because it just says that you can get things to contract or you can get things to expand. Now, what about the Weyl tensor? Well, the Weyl tensor, you know, comes from the trace free part of the Riemann tensor. And it is trace free. It's anti-symmetric versus the stress energy tensor and the Ricci tensor, which are both symmetric. And also, so it's not related directly to the stress energy tensor, unlike the other stuff. So given a specific energy momentum distribution, there's still some freedom of choice for the Weyl tensor, since it doesn't really relate directly to the stress energy tensor. And so if we use the Bianchi identity here, then we can rewrite the divergence of the Weyl tensor in terms of the stress energy tensor. Because all we did was we just took the divergence of this equation up here at the top and we contracted it down using the Bianchi identity. And then we use Einstein's equations to rewrite that in terms of the stress tensor. So we can, by doing this, we kind of have an indirect way of relating the Weyl tensor to the stress energy tensor. And to first order, solutions are going to depend on the boundary conditions because this is just a divergence. This is not a direct Weyl tensor in terms of stress energy tensor. This is just dealing with derivative terms. And so what this does for us is that it actually tells us how things propagate. Since when you look at the other solution, it's like you have a static solution where you're relating one thing to another, and it can kind of give you initial conditions. And then since this is divergences, it's basically telling you how does this thing change, and so it gives you a propagation equation. And it's similar in a lot of ways to what we did with the electromagnetic field tensor in Maxwell's equations. And so Maxwell's equations here led us to electromagnetic waves, and this is going to lead us in a way to gravitational waves, where you could see that all of this stuff involving the derivatives of the stress energy tensor are effectively they're like current. And so another thing about Einstein's general relativity is it only works above the quantum scale. And so here I wrote Planck's constant, Newton's gravity constant, and the speed of light. Three of the fundamental constants of nature. And you can combine these units to give you units of mass, length, time, energy, and pretty much anything else. And so you can see that you naturally get this unit of mass called the Planck mass, which is 2.18 times 10 to the minus 5 grams. Or a Planck length, which is something like 10 to the minus 33 centimeters. Planck time is 10 to the minus 44 seconds. And Planck energy, which is 10 to the 16 ergs. All right. Can anybody tell me why it is that we don't have any particles larger than a Planck mass, like no fundamental particles of nature? Okay. All right, well, if any of you have an answer to that, you can just send the paper to the Nobel Committee.
10 to the minus 5th grams?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, if you think about it,
so this is 21 micrograms.
Right. And if you think about that, is huge compared to any fundamental particle.
Yeah.
Well, one idea from this came from doubly special relativity, where they basically put in a second invariant scale into special relativity and use that to say that, well, you can't get anything bigger than that. But also, an interesting thing happens. If you actually had a fundamental particle that was this big, then it would actually be like a microscopic black hole. It would actually form a black hole with a Schwarzschild radius equal to this. And it would have this energy. Also, in cosmology, these numbers come up a lot, because this Planck time is the furthest back anybody can even do a calculation of the universe. If you go back, you look at every cosmology text, it gets down to 10 to the minus 44 seconds, and then before that, it's just, nothing. We don't know. And it literally, the physics breaks down, and you can't say anything about it. So you've got this huge mass compared to a particle, but it's small compared to us. You've got this tiny length, and this length here corresponds to the highest possible frequency photon you could ever create or hope to create. And that photon would have this much energy. And, so these units all relate to each other.
But it would not have that mass.
Well, yeah, we don't have a fundamental particle with that mass. Not like an electron or a quark or something like that. I mean, you could have composite particles, which might have a bigger mass. Or you might have a molecule with a bigger mass, but not an individual particle. And so there was, so they were explaining the doubly special relativity, why you don't get particles of that mass. But then the hard part was then, okay, why do you get things with bigger mass than that? And then that became a completely other problem to deal with. But anyway, you can kind of think of these as just the ultimate limits for theoretical physics, especially when it deals with gravity. And so anything that happens at quantum gravity is going to happen on this scale. All right, so this brings us to the cosmological constant. And as you can see, this is what happens when you have paper that's sort of a little bit darker that you take your notes on. So I talked a little bit about this before, but the idea is that the source of gravitation in general relativity is the energy momentum tensor. Instead of, just looking at differences in energy like you see in Newtonian physics. Like in Newtonian physics, it's not the absolute energy that matters, it's the difference in energy. But in Einstein's gravity, there's always sort of this absolute that comes into play. And the normalization of energy is not just an arbitrary thing. You can't just say that we're sitting at zero energy. So you run into a few problems that you don't necessarily see in gravity that you would not have a problem with in Newtonian physics. Can everybody kind of see that relative energy thing? It's kind of like if you look at electromagnetic potential. You never actually measure potential, you just measure the potential difference. And in Newtonian gravity, you might have, kinetic energy, which is defined by this, potential energy, which is defined by height and the gravitational acceleration. But in Einstein's world, you can make the world look flat, but you're still going to get this inner gravity because you're always going to have this energy. And so this brings us to vacuum energy, which is the energy density of empty space. And the idea being that from quantum field theory, we know that particles can pop in and out of existence. And that energy, empty space actually can contain a lot of energy, even if you can't do anything directly. And one example of this is the Casimir force, where they actually would take these metal plates and they put them close to each other but not touching, with the idea that there's all this electromagnetic energy in the vacuum, and there are more wavelengths on the outside of the plates than between the two, because they're so close together, and it would actually create a force that would push the plates together. And that's another example of vacuum energy. But if there's all this vacuum energy and energy curves space-time, then this vacuum energy should affect the curvature of space-time. So for space to be isotropic, the vacuum energy momentum tensor should be Lorentz invariant and locally inertial coordinates. So in other words, the vacuum energy looks the same to all the different observers. And so, you know, since the laws of physics are going to be the same, so this vacuum energy has to be Lorentz invariant. And so if we rewrite the stress energy tensor for vacuum energy in terms of the vacuum energy density here in this flat space metric, it should imply then that the vacuum energy tensor is the same thing as having this vacuum energy density times the curve space metric. And in the vacuum, the pressure should be equal to minus the energy density. So in other words, you should have a lot more pressure than you have energy density. And so this comes from the fact that the stress energy tensor here is written as the sum of rho and p in the four velocities and then the pressure with this metric term. And so the Einstein's equation then gives you the curvature on the left-hand side, and on the right-hand side you've got the stress energy tensor for matter, and then this is the stress energy tensor for the vacuum, because the total stress energy should give you the curvature. And so what happens is this term right here basically just goes with the metric, and so we were able to pull it together and just put it on the left-hand side. And this stress energy tensor for the matter, or whatever other matter mass we have, is sitting on the right-hand side, where this lambda term here is called a cosmological constant. And it's basically, you know, the energy density of the vacuum normalized with Newton's gravity constant and everything else. And so this still works within Einstein's equation, because you can take the divergence, and when you take the divergence here, you're taking the divergence of the metric, which is zero by definition, so end up with, you know, same rule apply. So this is the idea that vacuum energy should, you know, just add a constant term in to the curvature, because this vacuum energy is everywhere, and it's not really, you know, it doesn't depend on your location or anything like that. You can't really get outside of it. And so there should be this kind of constant curvature to the universe, which is the cosmological constant. Now, if you use the cosmological constant in your action equation, then this is now your equation for action. And you can see that you've got your action, you've got your Ricci term, like before, and then you're subtracting off this cosmological constant term. And Lm, which is the Lagrangian for mass. And we have this Lagrangian for the vacuum, which is just basically equal to minus the density, mass energy density of the vacuum. And
the pressure of the vacuum.
What? Oh, the pressure of the vacuum. Remember, the pressure of the vacuum, it just relates directly to the vacuum energy. So either way you want to write it, because they're basically the same thing. And, you know, you could see here that if the pressure and the energy density are the same, then this term falls out, and you're just left with this term, which is the same thing as minus the energy density. So it's easier to write, think of it as terms of energy density than in terms of pressure. Okay. So this means that constants are going to satisfy least action with respect to the metric, still. Same way they did before. Because it's, you know, it's a constant still. And you do your variation, it's still going to, it's not really going to change much. Now, among the sources of vacuum energy are what they call zero-point quantum fluctuations, where the idea is that in quantum mechanics, the lowest allowed energy state is going to be E naught equals 1/2 H bar omega. And you can show from quantum mechanics that you always have this simple harmonic oscillator with this frequency. And it's always going to be the ground state of whatever your system is. In each allowed frequency, this results in an infinite energy density. Because if you sum over all the different potential frequencies, and there's an infinite number of frequencies, then you end up getting an infinite energy if you get to go up to an infinite length. Normally what you would do in a calculation, if you really want to find a cutoff, is you would go all the way down to like a Planck scale and say that there's no frequencies allowed below that or something like that. In which case you get a non-infinite answer, just a really huge one. So if you'd use the cutoff wave number, and I'm sorry this came out like this, but this is supposed to be K max, and this is called the ultraviolet momentum cutoff, or the highest allowed wave number, then you could say that the density, energy density of the vacuum goes like H bar K to the 4th max, which you could see relates directly to that. And so we just wrote it in terms of wave number as opposed to writing it in terms of frequency. Then if you assume quantum field theory works all the way up to the Planck scale, then what happens is that you end up getting this effective energy in the vacuum equal to 10 to the 18th GeV to the 9th power, which is 10 to the 112 ERBs per centimeter cubed of density, of energy density. So you can imagine that. That's a 1 with 112 zeros behind it, grams per cubic centimeter. That means that in 1 cubic centimeter of empty space, there's more energy than we would ever need to power our entire planet for the rest of your life. And if you
follow the definition of a Google, 10 to the 100.
Yeah, 10 to the 100.
So this is a trillion times that.
Yeah. A trillion Googles. So, cosmological observations imply that this vacuum energy should actually be on the order of, this should be 10 to the minus 8 ERBs per centimeter cubed, as opposed to 10 to the 112 ERBs per centimeter cubed. This means that we're off by 120 orders of magnitude.
Yeah, in a cubic centimeter, there's 110 to the 112
ERGs. Yeah.
And then how do we drop down to 10 to the minus 8?
Oh, this is based on theory, and this is based on observation.
Oh.
I think that's how many orders of magnitude I'm off on my homework.
This is more than the dark matter argument. Right?
Oh yeah.
80 or 90%. This is
dark energy.
Yeah.
This is 80 or 90% is 101 multiplied by 1. You're multiplying it by 120.
Yeah. 120 zeros.
We figured this out.
No. That's a good question. The answer is no. We haven't figured this out. And nobody has any idea on why it's that far off. Because, I mean, this is basically this number, 10 to the minus 8 ERBs per centimeter cube. This is with dark energy. You know, this is basically the contribution of dark energy to causing the expansion of the universe and them being able to calculate it.
Wait, this is what we observe?
Yeah, this is what we observe.
So apparently we're missing another 120, you know, how to measure these.
Something like that, yeah. So yeah, it's almost like saying that there's all this energy, but which should be affecting the curvature of space-time, but it's not. And it's actually a good thing, because if you're if you actually had this much vacuum energy of 10 to the 112 ergs per centimeter cubed, the entire universe would be like the size of a pea because of the contraction and curvature of gravity. And, you know, you wouldn't even see your own nose because it would be right behind you somewhere. So this is one of those things where theory is just not have a clue. And this is one of those things where they think having a quantum theory of gravity would be good.
Are they kind of sure they're right about those two numbers?
Yeah. Well, this number is definitely right, the observation number. Because they can measure that directly and say that this is, you know, the energy density. And basically, by back calculating Einstein's equation, you can calculate this pretty accurate. The 120 is, it's like how did, the way they came up with this 112 here, basically just came from this whole argument about, from quantum mechanics. And so this number came from quantum mechanics and calculated forward energy density from what space-time should be. And this number came from observation and then using general relativity to calculate backwards to get to the energy density. And so this is what they mean when they say that Einstein's general relativity is not compatible with quantum mechanics.
Okay.
Because quantum mechanics is giving you that first answer, general relativity, and everything is giving you this answer. And this answer seems pretty reasonable, given that, you know, our universe isn't the size of a pea.
And the other answer does not seem reasonable.
It doesn't seem reasonable, but there's no way to really argue against it.
So this means we could have parallel
universes. This is some of the explanations people had. Parallel universes and a lot of this gravitational energy is seeking into the other universes, or maybe there, some of the quantum energy is inside of these other universes and are split up or something like that.
Or maybe the assumptions they use in the theory are
wrong,
are not applicable for vacuum energy.
Maybe. But, like I said, this is the big problem. And the interesting thing, the thing I found the most ironic about this is that when you look at the history, you know, there was Newtonian physics, and that basically explained the whole universe. And then there was Maxwell, you know, his theory. And actually, another interesting side note, there's this website where called Math Genealogy, and you can kind of trace these different PhDs and whose advisor did what and trace them down the chain. And Maxwell is actually a great descendant of Newton. And Newton's descendants are still graduating with PhDs and stuff now, too. But anyway, so Maxwell came up with his theory of electromagnetism. He combined all those equations together beautifully and was able to come up with electromagnetic waves and all this other stuff. And he explained the rest of the universe that Newton couldn't explain. The problem was the two were not compatible, because when you got to the Galilean transformation, which kind of implied that the speed of light was infinite, and then you look at the actual results from Maxwell's, they didn't work together. Einstein shows up, and he fixes this. He unites Maxwell and Newton, and at least in flat space, and he says this works. And then he didn't stop there. Then he becomes one of the early pioneers of quantum theory with the photoelectric effect and things like that. And he develops general theory of relativity based on the special relativity theory to explain gravity. The problem is now, since he did all that, we have now two new incompatible theories that don't work together, that explain the universe in different areas. So we went from two incompatible theories to two different incompatible theories. And hopefully sometime in the next few years, maybe we'll have a couple new completely incompatible theories. So, and this is where all these scientists, you hear about grand unification theories and why people are working on that. And that's because they're trying to get the quantum and the gravity to work together.
But quantum gravity would be incompatible with something else.
Yeah, we'll figure out a way to make it incompatible. Well, actually, I think what they're planning on doing is, you know, once they come with a quantum gravity theory, they'll just burn all other research. Okay, so that is the big thing, and that's the cosmological constant problem. Anybody who solves it gets a free ticket to Switzerland for a big award.
Sweden
for a big award. Thanks. So the goal here, when we talk about energy conditions, is that you have this Einstein equation, which relates the curvature to stress energy. And this stress energy, you need to put some kind of constraints on solving these equations. It's obviously just, you can't just have every little thing be a solution. And so you want to only have physically relevant solutions that are actually going to apply to something, usually something you can observe in cosmology or something like that. Or out, you know, with a telescope. And so we put in these energy conditions as to be constraints on our stress energy tensor to give you realistic energy momentum situations or sources. So what we do is we construct scalars from the stress energy tensor using time-like and null-like vectors, because we're going to assume that everything physical follows either a time-like vector or a null-like vector.
And null-like is like-like.
Like-like, yeah. So in other words, we're saying that particles that travel faster than the speed of light and go backwards in time or whatever are just not going to be physical. And so one example of that is that if you're given this general stress energy tensor, and these are four velocity terms, which can be time-like or null-like, then if you contract the stress energy tensor with these time-like vectors, then you could see there's a contraction going on here with the four vectors and with the metric. Then the result is going to be these two contracted together to give you some k scalar, which is squared, and this ends up being like a dot product of the two. And we say that k squared is going to be greater than or equal to t squared. And the reason why they came up with that was because, you know, four velocity can only be so large. So it's going to be, so k squared, most likely it's going to be like around the same size as t squared, or it can be maybe a little bit bigger. If this four velocity is time-like. So
what about the other four velocity?
Oh, they're both the same thing.
Okay.
Yeah. So, I mean, you're summing over mu and nu, so it's the same thing. So what that means is that this contraction of the stress tensor and this time-like vector is always going to be greater than or equal to zero if you assume that the energy density is positive and the sum of the energy density and the pressure is positive. So in other words, you know, for a time-like vector, something that moves like regularly through time, then rho is going to be positive because it's a mass of particle. And p might subtract off a little bit from rho, but the sum of those two are going to be positive. And then in which case, this term minus this term is still going to leave you with a positive number, which is going to be, you know, positive. So worst case scenario, you're going to get positive number. Now the weak energy condition, and he came with a whole bunch of different ones here. The weak energy condition basically says that this thing is positive for all time-like t's where you have these two being positive. So same thing I just said. And the pressure is small compared to the energy density. The null energy condition is basically where you'd use two light-like stress tensors. And you could see that you still end up with a positive value for your scalar, but that's assuming that your energy density plus your pressure is going to be positive or zero. And so you can actually have, you know, sort of a close to zero energy. You know, negative energy is allowed here, but the sum of the energy and the pressure is still going to give you something positive. The dominant energy condition is where you take, again, contracting with the time-like vectors, and this is going to give you that your energy density is going to be greater than or equal to the pressure, only the energy condition is not negative. The pressure could be negative here. And you notice that if you contract the stress energy tensor with one of the time-like vectors, you cannot get a space-like vector. And then the null dominant energy condition is basically saying, you know, again, you're going to get something positive, but here pressure is equal to minus the energy density. So you can have negative energy density and a positive pressure, or negative pressure and positive energy density, whatever. And again, you can't have a space-like vector here. And then the strong energy condition is that this term here, contracting the stress energy tensor with the time-like vector, is always going to be greater than or equal to one-half the contraction of the stress energy tensor with itself and the contraction of the time-like vectors with itself for all time-like vectors. And therefore, the total of the energy density and the pressure is going to be greater than zero, and you can't. And the total for the energy density and three times the pressure is going to be greater than zero. So you're always going to get an attractive gravity, not a repulsive gravity. And so no large negative pressures are going to happen here. And so, oh, and this also, they sometimes use this equation of state, which is just the ratio of the pressure and the density. Now, if you look on page 146 in the book, what this does is this is just, oh, yeah, thank you, 176. I've been programming all day, so my brain's halfway gone. You can see here that these are just basically the regimes where all the different energy conditions work. And you can see, for example, here with the weak energy condition, you can't have negative energy density. But under the null energy condition, you can actually have negative energy, but it has to be balanced out with this positive pressure. And so on. So you can kind of, from this, see that there's certain regimes you can be in and some you can't. And then here, where they take omega to be greater than or equal to negative 1, you get this really weird shape where you can actually have negative pressure and negative energy density and still get something that works. So the idea is that when you're dealing with the physical situation, you can kind of define what energy conditions have to be met, and then you can write your system appropriately. So for most classical matter, you're going to get the dominant energy condition, which is this one here, where you've got positive energy density and pressure could be positive or negative. And if it obeys the dominant energy condition, then it automatically obeys the weak energy condition, the null energy condition, and the null dominant energy condition. And the strong energy condition may be violated if you have a massive scalar field. And so remember, the strong energy condition was this one, which basically just said, well, as long as you have gravity, it's attractive, nobody, everything else is fine. And what happens is, in cosmology in the early universe, they believe there was a huge scalar field, and it actually caused the universe to expand. And so that would have violated this strong energy condition. Quantum fields also may violate the energy conditions because when you have a quantum field, it can fluctuate, and it can fluctuate from one state to another. So it could violate an energy condition for a short period of time and then come back. And, you know, as far as what's the period of time that's allowed or anything, it's kind of hard to tell.
Planck time.
Planck time, or shorter than Planck time, or you know, maybe a little longer, but then it averages out to be within the energy condition. Who knows? So it's it gets really interesting as far as the physics goes, and when you try to think about when you can violate these things and how long you can violate them and what does that mean for the physical systems you're looking at. And so you can sometimes you can look at a physical system and you could say you could see easily that it violates that energy condition and know that that's not going to be a reasonable solution or it's going to be something really interesting. So the equivalence principle is used to justify one, the physical laws should be expressible in covariant form. And when they mean covariant form, they mean that you can do a coordinate transformation or Lorentz transformation to get from one manifold, you know, to make the manifold look different. And all the physical laws are still going to work. And so, relativity, in essence. There is a metric on the space-time, and gravity comes from the curvature of that space-time. There are no other fields that behave like gravity. In other words, if you did have another field that acted like gravity and you really couldn't tell the difference between the two, then gravity's not unique and there's something wrong. And so there should always be some experiment you could do to see if you're dealing with gravity and show that it's not something else. And there is a minimum amount of interaction between matter fields and curvature. And so anytime you have a matter field, there's always going to be some curvature. And so if you go through each one of these statements, first off, all terms in the equation transform the same way under the change of coordinates, and therefore the equation is coordinate invariant. And so if we express physical laws in terms of tensors, then they become coordinate invariant. And so an example of this is from Maxwell's equations. If we write them like this in terms of tensors, then we could change the basis vectors to whatever coordinate system we want. And so in flat space, this is Maxwell's equations. But then in curved space, this is Maxwell's equation. And everything works, it's just that this partial derivative became a covariant derivative. From statement two, the equivalence principle implies that gravity is universal and therefore impossible to measure in small regions of space. Therefore, gravity can be linked to geometry. So, if gravity is everywhere in the universe, and if you measure small regions of space-time and you see this curvature, then you can just say that the two are related. Statement three basically says that if you test the equivalence principle, you also test for other fields that resemble gravity. For example, long-range forces that couple almost universally to mass. And so if you can find some other force that acts over very long distances and couples universally to mass, then that tells you something else is out there that looks like gravity and that doesn't fit within the theory.
What if it is gravity?
Yeah, well then that shows you got gravity. And so detecting a violation would imply some fifth force that we haven't heard of. And if you think about it, we've got four forces in nature. The strong force is extremely strong compared to the other ones. It's what holds quarks together. But the force does not weaken over distance. And so it's so strong, though, that it doesn't look anything like gravity. The weak force is much weaker than the electromagnetic force, and that's like where you get these, decay that happens in radioactivity. And that's a very short-range thing. Electromagnetic force is much longer range than the weak force, but it's not nearly as long range as something like gravity. It's not infinite range. In gravity, it works over very long distances, but it seems pretty weak.
Electromagnetic force is not coupled to mass.
Right, it doesn't couple to mass, it only couples to charge. And if you neutralize the charge, like you do over far enough distance, it kind of doesn't do anything. So, and then finally, Couplings are minimal. And what that means is that there should be some minimal set of equations that you need to describe gravity, and that, you know, adding more onto it won't really do anything. So if you had, for example, the geodesic equation, it looks like this, where we add in this extra term, which is the divergence of the Ricci scalar, or gradient of Ricci scalar, then it would allow for direct detection of curvature in small regions using this, since the more curvature is going to directly detect the change in the geodesic. Now, this term alpha is the one we're going to pay attention to, because you can kind of tune this term alpha away and get rid of this extra piece. For dimensional analysis, alpha should go like length squared. And if you assume that alpha goes like the Planck length squared, then this implies the right-hand side is 10 to the minus 102 times the left-hand side of the gravitational field of the Earth. And that's something you can't detect. So in other words, this could be true, but if it is, there's no way to measure it.
Yet.
Possibly not ever. But the principle of equivalence is a consequence of general relativity being a macroscopic effect in field theory. So it's because of the fact that you can kind of add together all this mass and see the effect that you get this equivalence principle. So it could be the equivalence principle is wrong, and we just can't tell because we're only dealing with gravity and not quantum gravity. And when you get to quantum gravity, I mean, that's another problem, because, you know, if you got something that's really small already, like gravitational field's relatively weak compared to everything else, and then you're looking for tiny variations in that, then it's kind of like the needle in the haystack problem. Okay. All right. So, last thing I want to talk about from chapter 4, and this deals with alternative theories to general relativity. And so obviously, anytime you look at anything in physics, there's always the possibility that we're wrong. And the idea here is to kind of go through, and you can see what some other people have worked on, and see if we're wrong, where we're wrong, and what people have kind of thought of we could be wrong at. And so some things you do to modify general relativity, you can add gravitational scalar fields, extra dimensions, higher order action terms, non-Christoffel connections. You notice these are extra spatial dimensions, because an extra time-like dimension could be kind of confusing. And Euler tensor theories that use both the metric and some scalar field, which couples to the curvature. So there's a lot of different things you can do. For this scalar tensor theory, the way you would do this is, I'm not going to go into detail on all of these, obviously, because, you know, there's been so many theories out there that you can never really keep up. But for scalar theory, tensor theory, then what happens is you can think of the action as the sum of the action caused by curvature plus the scalar action and the mass action, where each one of these relates to the stress energy tensor from each one, or the Lagrangian from each one. And so for the curvature part, it basically has this function of the scalar times the curvature. And so what this does is it says that, you know, you still have the curvature, but it also has some effect from the scalar. For the scalar Lagrangian, they basically wrote this thing, you know, to look like here's a scalar potential, and these terms are kind of meant to look like a kinetic energy piece. And H is sort of like a parameter, kind of like F is here, which kind of can... And so the idea is you can kind of tune this down and tune this up and get back to a regular curvature theory of gravity, or however you want to do it. And then for matter, you just have a Lagrangian from the matter, which depends on the metric and on whatever vector the matter field is doing. And so you can think of F, H, and U as functions, where U is the potential and F and H are these kind of fine-tuning constants or functions. And psi are matter fields. And so all you have to do is now find the delta in the action. And the delta in the action is going to relate to a delta in the metric and a delta in the scalar field. And so you can go through each one of the terms. Here's the first term just for from the delta in the curvature. And you can see you've got a term here that looks like the Einstein tensor, but with this extra F term on it. And then you've got the metric and the box of F. And then you've got this second derivative of F. And so you can see here that if you take F equal to 1, then these two terms disappear. And you're just left with the Einstein tensor. So the Einstein tensor, what you get from this, the Einstein tensor could be written in terms of these stress energy tensor terms. This one's for matter, this one's for the scalar field, and then these extra two pieces. And the stress energy tensor for Taylor field, you can see it varies by H, but it also has all these gradients of the scalar field. And so if you allow this scalar field to vary with position, and so there's a little delta in it, then that's going to imply that your space-time is going to be dependent on Newton's constant, and that all of a sudden Newton's constant is really no longer a constant. Newton's gravity constant?
Okay.
Yeah. And so this scalar field is, or the scalar that you're going to have to, that this thing's going to have to obey, is going to work like this, where this is basically derivatives of the scalar field. It has to couple with the gravity field. And then you've got U prime and F prime H. And I believe all these primes are just partial derivatives with respect to something. Yeah, partial. These are all partial derivatives with respect to lambda for these prime terms. Okay, so you would end up with having something like this to deal with in addition to everything else from relativity. Now, the oldest and one of the most popular of these scalar tensor theories is the Brans-Dickey theory, where F of lambda is just lambda over 16 pi, and H of lambda is omega over 8 pi lambda. And the potential was taken to be zero. And so when you do that, this is the equation that you get for your Brans-Dickey action. And if you take your omega term and you take the this W term, you take it to infinity, this implies ordinary general relativity because H ends up blowing up. And then you can tell that for our solar system, this W has to be greater than 500. Otherwise, you would get something that won't work right from our observations, at least within our solar system. So you can kind of imply all these other theories, and then you could put limits on them. And you could see that these are other theories are like supersets of Einstein's theory, where you take the right limits and you can recover Einstein's theory. And finally, there's a little bit about extra dimensions, and everybody's heard of string theory, I guess. And the idea is that we observe four total dimensions, but you can have more dimensions than that. And you can have four plus D total dimensions, where D are known as compactified dimensions, so that if you look at them from far away, you only see four dimensions. And the first people to come up with a higher dimensional version of Einstein's theory was Kaluza-Klein back in the 1920s, and where they were actually using four-vector potential from electromagnetism as like another dimension. And when you add in these extra, and since these equations of general relativity, they don't really say how many dimensions you have to use, you can actually add on extra dimensions. Can't prove it's wrong. Okay. All right, so that's it for chapter 4. Any questions? Well, let me give you the next homework out. And what I think I'm going to do is this homework here that was due today, we'll just say that's Thursday. And if anybody has any other questions on it or still having any issues with it, you could just email me and we can hopefully meet. The last problem set here is going to be only be 5 questions. So going back from 8 to 5.
Yeah.
And the target date for that is the 21st, but we could see how that works if we have to move it. Because I'm willing to let these slip a day, and I'm actually thinking the take-home final might not be due until after the last class, so I give you guys a few extra days to work on it. It's a lot harder to plan when everything's so jumbled together in the summertime. And I do know this is a lot of material. Yeah, so chapter 5 and 6 are basically about black holes, and they're the first applications of general relativity you're really getting to in here. Because when you look at what we've done so far, chapter 1 has been an advanced math review. Chapter 2, I think, was the one where we started talking about manifolds. Chapter 3 started getting the curvature. Chapter 4 started trying to put it together into general relativity. So chapter 5 is beginning black holes. Chapter 6 is more advanced black holes. And then 7 is gravitational waves, and 8 is cosmology, I believe. So what we're going to do effectively is we'll get one lecture from chapter 7 and one lecture from chapter 8, and I'm not sure how far we're going to really get through either one of those. But I am not, most likely I'm not going to cover the whole chapter. It'd just be enough for you to wet your feet on it, so that if later on you decide you want to read more and learn more about it, you'll be in very understanding of it. But actually, when you look at this stuff, just looking at chapter 4, having gotten all the way through chapter 4, you've got enough of an understanding now to where if you were to go and read something about general relativity, like read a scientific paper published anywhere on it, you would have a very good understanding of what's going on. If it's specifically on cosmology or black holes, you might need to study a little bit more, but you at least understand the principles of everything. All right, so anything else?